You're listening to the Yeshiva of Newark podcast. I'm your host and curator, Rabbi Avram Kivalevich, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Shalom, this is Shmoozing with Rav Meir Shiller, Meir in Chachamim. Rav Meir, this coming Thursday, July 4th, will be 244 years since the Declaration of Independence was penned and the U.S. declared its independence from Britain. So, Rav Meir, I think that it's a time for us to really talk about the political assumptions that were present in the founding of our country, especially since there's been a lot of talk in the air of what are we? Are we really a democracy? As someone who is quite well-versed in these issues and understands the state of our political landscape today, let's go back sort of like in an originalist manner to what this country was found on, and let's contrast what would have been the Torah view on the assumptions of the founders who sort of brought this country into existence.
America is actually a combination of many historical influences, and we should not slight in terms of those influences the Old Testament, the New Testament, but surely Greece and Rome, and then the Reformation and the Enlightenment, and perhaps throw in the Renaissance before the Reformation, they yield what America is. Now, the key with America, as opposed to the French Revolution, let's say, is that America sought to maintain some level of Christian element, Christian injection into this mix of Greece, Rome, Reformation, Enlightenment, and try to somehow impregnate its institutions with some level of, for lack of a better term, Enlightenment-esque Christianity. And that is what they tried to pull off, I think, certainly in the Declaration of Independence, which is a sort of a mischievous Enlightenment document, but more so with the Constitution and, of course, the Bill of Rights, and reaching back, let's not leave out here the Mayflower Compact with the influences of the assorted English dissenters who came here, the Pilgrims and the Puritans, because they also play a role in America's self-image. So I think when you raise the question of democracy, obviously to the founding fathers, the word democracy was not a positive word. They viewed it as the masses, the mobocracy, and they sought to insert in the Constitution many devices to limit the extent of popular rule. And we think in this context of the Senate being not voted upon by the people originally, the Electoral College, which was devoted to trying to get the presidency out of the hands of the voters and put in the hands of an astute elite. So there were many ways in which the founding fathers feared direct democracy and feared extensive democracy, and therefore they injected this element of a more distanced republican government over the whims, the passing whims of the masses, certainly the Senate as opposed to the House, the six-year term as opposed to the two-year term, was another device in order to do that. So I think when they say republic, not democracy, I think historically it is correct. On the term democracy itself, and I'm going to inject a radical thought here, I don't think there is any such thing as a democracy. I don't think the masses of people have any original thoughts. I think their thoughts are all those given to it by today, I would say, media and education, so that the direction of the electorate is not something which they themselves come upon. They can think within the parameters which the social elites of education and media impose upon them. So I don't think there's any such thing as a democracy in which people reach any decisions, and America is where it is because of those factors.
You know, many of my friends who cannot find careers in the teaching yeshiva world, or were worried that they would not, made the jump into law. And you do have so many fellows who never even went to a real secular university and yet used a lot of their yeshiva credits, as it were, to get into law school. And there in law school, many of them have become standouts because of the fact that they were used to parsing and dealing with contracts, legal terms. And I think especially the spirit that what does the law say? What does the Constitution say? And that really comes from the top up. In other words, even the local legislatures and bylaws are used to being read and argued about because the founders, or at least the early American leaders, put the Constitution in such a hallowed place. And we've had years of arguments and interpretations and biurim. It seems to be unique. Can you think of any other governments on the globe that always go back to Vushtate? Did anyone glorify the language the way the United States did?
Yes, there is a truth to what you're saying, but I think that what America does, because of this hallowization of the Constitution, is that when they want to engage in social revolution, they just reinterpret the words. And I think one of the most glaring examples of that would be First Amendmentitis, where we take the words of Congress not respecting the establishment of religion, nor prohibiting free exercise thereof. And this morphs over 200 years to prohibiting religious teachings and prayer in public schools, which would you have landed in the 1870s or 1920s and looked at the McGuffey readers, which were common in that era, there would have been tons of explicit religious teaching. Every school day began with prayer and Bible reading, including my own in PS 206 in Queens, because it was before the Warren Court decisions. So I think that what America does simply is that it takes the words and says, how can I force our new set of social dogmas into these words? And eventually you get, you know, an Earl Warren or someone like him comes along and says, okay, these words mean you cannot have prayer in public school, which would you have told the founding fathers that? They would have fallen out of their vasa shichen zaken.
Their sheitlach would have fallen off in the shaking and quaking that they would have engaged in.
Take, for example, the examples I gave before of the founding fathers' disdain for a total democracy, and take the non-direct election of senators and the electoral college in its original meaning. And today, the dogmas of America are, in fact, at war. If you would suggest today those notions of anti-democracy to anybody today, including your phoniest of phony Republican conservatives, they would all say that's evil, that's terrible. So there's very little which having these words, I think, accomplishes. It increases the pilpulistic skills of the judiciary. Take Brown v. Board. There are six decisions post-Plessy which uphold separate but equal. And then Brown v. Board comes along and says, Sal Shtusim, we know the truth about the Reconstruction Amendments. So again, not taking a position on any of that, but just saying how the whole intent of the whole business varies according to the domination of education and media.
There are ways that these statements can be turned and horribly into something grotesque. But it is interesting that there was sort of this idea that they were bringing forth something greater than themselves. it wasn't just a way to be free from England. They really convinced themselves, I think, that they were somehow on the cusp of something that hadn't been done in a human achievement up until that point. I'm not saying that they weren't full of vapors in their brain, but I think they meant it. I think if you read the Federalist Papers and other things, there's an excitement to what they were crafting and what they thought they were bringing into the world. Even the overall effect and supposedly the influence on the French Revolution, seemingly a lot of it was the excitement of this American experiment.
Well, I think that's certainly true, although this revolutionary spirit was emerging all around in Europe and was, in a paradox of history, the great emperor dictator Napoleon has seeks to spread the liberal spirit across Europe. And of course, he is defeated. And then you get the counter-revolutions of post-Congress of Vienna and Metternich and all that. So again, I think these things were sprouting up everywhere, but certainly the American attempt and a somewhat degree success of it does influence many revolutionary movements across Europe throughout the ages, and eventually metamorphosizes into the mind-controlling media and education of today. So it not only does it abandon the more traditional assumptions of that world, but it abandons its very liberal assumptions about freedom and discussion and open debate. So again, you can plan whatever you want to plan, but the Revolution für die Welt.
You mentioned when we started that so much of what their mindset, and at least some of them, whether it was Roger Williams, Rhode Island, or others, were taken by a very much a biblical perspective, a Christian perspective. You know, I've read Jefferson's letters quite a bit and others. It was a shtickel of chulent. I think there were some of the—
Very much so.
There were some that were mamish. We could sit here and talk and learning and talk about the Rabbeinu Shalom, and we would mamish go walk with them hand in hand in the perception of who God was and Har Sinai and other things.
Right. If you think about it, Roger Williams, he flees the Massachusetts of those days. Now, Massachusetts, established by Pilgrims and Puritans, is not, as it's often portrayed, people yearning for religious liberty as liberty. They're seeking liberty from the Anglican Church of England. They are dissenters, puritanical dissenters, who think the Church of England is a little too papist and a little too Catholic. So they're running away from that. But once they get to Massachusetts, they proceed to set up what we would see today as theocratic dictatorships. And even Roger Williams, who runs away, still wants to do it under a kind of Christian auspices. So it's only with, I think, Quakers and Anabaptists, maybe, where we begin to hear a little bit of something approaching the America of, let's say, the 20th century, although not the 21st, but America of the 20th century, which believes in a notion of religious freedom. The Pilgrims and the Puritans, they were the last ones, boy. If you would have consecrated your host in Plymouth Rock, you would have been in big trouble. So again, it's not what we think it is often.
With downloads approaching the million mark, in an archival library numbering in the thousands, the Yeshiva of Newark podcast has been striving to continuously upgrade our content, professionalize our audio sound, along with altering approaches in light of much appreciated listener feedback. I firmly believe that a niche has been carved out that resonates with many on the wide spectrum of observant Jews. This explains why we continually rank high in independent online lists of top Yeshiva podcasts. That proud edifice is in real danger of toppling and disappearing. We need the help of our listeners to continue to record and edit, to promote a product that has been a balm and instructor to so many. Just $36 as a minimum donation from 1,000 of you out there will keep us afloat as a Newark of straight, intelligent, humorous discussion, lectures, debate, and inquiry, while the destructive waters of ignorance and identity politics, cyberbullying, crash around us. Your generous contributions will seal and galvanize this ark till it comes to a satisfying rest in an era of Moyer Tzdeya, heralding Mashiach. B'mheira, b'yameinu, amen. We talk about, 1776 and the heroes of that time. And Washington had quite a liberal and tolerant approach towards Jewish citizens of the United States. The letter that George Washington wrote to the Jewish community doesn't sound like of a political hack. It sounds like he really appreciates. And even when he calls for national days of Thanksgiving, speaks about the synagogues, it seems like, at least in that initial period, there was a quite a welcoming and a place for the Jews. And this really explains why the scent of America becomes like catnip to the Jews in Europe. And this becomes this tantalizing place to go to. But it would seem like that period post 1776 was a place that was that Jews could come to and really thrive, and which is, of course, perhaps explains why there has been such a tremendous recognition of the American experiment on July 4th and celebration. I mean, I saw it by Rebbes, I saw it by the Il Aruv, who Rav Meisels. This is, of course, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Meisels' younger brother, Rav Dovid, who was in Miami. There were many who recognized the welcoming and the spirit. Could anybody ever contemplate, a world without American Jewry? It's almost impossible to think about Judaism without it. But let's talk about the Torah views, not just how without the Hakaras HaTov issue, but why don't you talk about the Torah views on democracy itself and these First Amendment freedoms?
This is one of the most troubling questions, I think, which Jews who seek some degree of political integrity have to grapple with. And that is when we argue in our public advocacy for what you call First Amendment identity and so forth, that when we adopt that and advocate for that, are we saying that it is the Torah worldview? Is that what the Malchus or the Sanhedrin would have instituted in Eretz Yisrael? Is it what they did institute in Eretz Yisrael? Was that a society of religious freedom of assembly, of freedom of speech? And I think the answer is no. And it morphs into Israel today, which clearly is to some degree, a religious, ethnic, identity-based community. So it emerges sort of, and I'm going to be critical for the moment, and I'm going to try to fend for the criticism. It would seem that what we advocate for in America is in order to create in America and throughout Europe, in order to create space for us to be us. But whether it is good for the host nation and the continuity of its identity, that I'm not so sure about, and I'm not sure that we worry about that or care about that. To face the reality of this contradiction, I think, is too painful for almost all of Jewry to bear, so that we favor homogeneity in our own world. We favor homogeneity in Eretz Yisrael. The Torah favors a homogeneous society in Eretz Yisrael after Yeshua's entry into the land. Yet, we stand on the side of the American and French revolutions to destroy that uniting element amongst the Gentile nations. Now, could be that our position is we cannot trust the Gentiles to have a homogeneous countries, which I think that's what most Jews would say. Too bad for them. We cannot trust them when it comes to those issues. But on the other hand, I suspect that it might be a bit of a two-edged morality, that there's certain tribalism that lies at the root of it. Maybe that's what we're summoned to. but it is certainly a very, very difficult question to be able to answer that question at this point. So one point to add here, I think, is that the pre-1881 immigration to America, which is primarily Dutch and some Sfardim, they were a lot different than the primarily Eastern European immigration of 1881 to 1924. So it might have been easier for George Washington to issue that kind of kiruv message to the Dutch Jews than it might have been for him to issue that kind of kiruv message to millions of Eastern European Jews.
Unlike the Dutch Jews, who had thrived in quite a liberal atmosphere where they could become respected bankers and also accepted in society as significant contributors, yes, the Jews who came post the pogroms, the post-Kishinev period, let's say, they are desperate. They do not trust. They see America as a hole for a mouse or a rat to crawl through and hopefully survive in a better way than they had survived up until now.
Yes. And here we judge no one, because we were not there in Odessa in 1881 when the Black Hundreds were unleashed upon the Jews of the Ukraine. We're not judging. But what they did when they came here was they sought to soften the identity-based aspects of American culture. But, you know, you're right. Do we understand what they were trying to do? They want to make it a place that would not turn on them as their neighbors did in Kishinev and so forth. So it's understandable.
And I guess what happened, and this was, you hear this in the Drush Svarim, the sort of American mystique and geschmack starts to make its way into this next generation that comes. You know, the ones that were toddlers on the boat are the ones that were born here. And you see that there becomes the beginning of what is the assimilation.
It goes both ways. In other words, we are influenced by the American culture of that time, and we in turn seek to influence it back. So there's sort of a reciprocal relationship there for both.
Yeah, well, again, this I think sort of coalesces more in the 1920s and 30s, where you sort of have,
yes,
where you have the rise of this newborn Jewish American intellectualism who are pushing interesting, you know, as we know, whether it's the writers or the activists, the communists, the Jews are an incredible ferment of power in terms of like setting the intellectual tenor of what people are talking about and what should be done. But if you clear the deck and you just think objectively, yes, HaKoros HaTov notwithstanding, the amazing ability to thrive and to bribe and to create the Mekoymus of Torah, etc. We obviously know that, you know, as it's codified in the Rambam, that the mitzvah is to have a melech. And although the word melech by definition means taking advice and listening to others, right? To be nimlach.
But he's not voted on. He's certainly not voted on.
Although the Netziv and others explain that the melech, you know, becomes the melech based on popular haskoma, right? There's a popular haskoma for the melech. That's what happens with Shaul. And there is a sense of not a vote, but there is a sense of acceptance. And there is always the caveat that it's got to be someone who has the Torah with him. Menashe still has a Shei Melech, even though he's killing people and doing Avodah Zarah, he still has a Shei Melech.
But the Jewish king and the Jewish Malchus and the Sanhedrin have an imperative to counter the First Amendment in their approach to idolatry and their approach to even the affirmation of idolatry. So certainly that would not be in keeping with the Founding Fathers' vision either. I think in general, is there an element of popular acceptance? Every tribal chieftain has popular acceptance. I mean, you know, every tribal chieftain. And when he doesn't, then they're removed by the popular non-acceptance.
Ein melech b'leyam.
But that's everywhere. It's every monarchy. And I think that to somehow say that this system was in keeping with post-Reformation, post-Enlightenment political ideals. Again, it's something the Jews would like to think. I don't want to take it away from them because it makes them very happy. But I think it's nonsense.
The Pesukim are not so obvious, but based on the codification and the Mishnayos and Sanhedrin, it would seem that this is what we're asking for. And of course, when we say we want Mashiach, we want a Melech. What's interesting, again, let's just note for our listeners who are probably aware of it, but just to note, the Abravanel's opinion said from his sorry experiences with the kings of Portugal that this was not a real positive option. He felt that it was a reshus to have a melech, that it was no mitzvah. He says he sees the result of what monarchy leads to. It leads to tyranny. It leads to destroying of cultures. It leads to absolute power corrupting. And therefore, the Avarvanel says what makes more sense to him is more a Senate model, a model of enlightened group malchus. To him, it's a much better method.
Sure, the Electoral College, so as originally envisioned.
Right, but without necessarily a head honcho, you know, running everything.
Yeah, every group gets head honchos, as we will recall from third grade, right? In other words, every group dynamic winds up having head honchos. It's not possible without, yeah.
It's Rome before an emperor. There is a Senate, and there's discussion, and there's talking.
And the whoever selected that Senate in Rome was a severely limited electorate. But I think we've stumbled upon something which I think we can tie in with the unraveling to some degree, which we see today in Eretz Yisrael, with the unraveling when it comes to the power of the courts and the rioters in Tel Aviv. And that vision of the State of Israel, when contrasted with the vision of Haredim, Sfardim, and right-wing religious Zionists, and I think at the bottom of the picture, that is the fight. The fight is, do we want to have a state somehow, somewhat al pi Torah, or do we want to have a state that has no clear definition in terms of its identity? I think that is the root of why they're so mad on the streets of Tel Aviv, because they sense that this thing is moving due to demographics. It's moving away from the somewhat liberal ethnic nationalism of Israel's founding fathers, and it's moving towards something very, very different.
Well, not necessarily a theocracy, but a government that has in key positions of power people who ascribe to an ultimate theocracy. Maybe not now.
Yes, yes.
You know, it's interesting, Rameyer, that Yom HaTzmaut, which of course is clearly modeled almost completely on July 4th, even to the custom that arose among the secular Jews to go out and have a barbecue and have fireworks. And it's also an interesting copy in the sense that when the Declaration of Independence was signed, the war was far from over. And it's interesting that the celebration was not the victory, similar to the, you know, Hey Eeyore, because they still had to, that actually, you know, it was, they still had to fight into 1949. And it's interesting that America did not somehow sanctify the final retreat of the Brits.
Yorktown, Cornwallis.
Cornwallis and Yorktown. Yes. That somehow is a date that is somewhere in the air, but rather, you know, the young Thomas Jefferson finishing this document with all the scratch outs and finally giving it to some proto newspaper to publish. I find that interesting that we somehow celebrate a day where, as many people have commented, that the ideas in the Declaration of Independence were really just, it was a statement that was really secondary to the Constitution and the actual running of the law of the country. And yet we sort of like put on a pedestal this declaration that was done in the midst of the war, a declaration to say we want to have the war and we're pushing back, and also a document which really has no legal status. But it's interesting that it's about that declaration of independence.
So in France, July 14th is the storming of the Bastille Day. In 1789. Right. In many ways, I think these three revolutions have an element of similarity. And I think it's something you mentioned earlier. And that is they're all seeking a break, an abrupt break with something that was before. Those founders of Israel, they thought they were creating something brand new, the suntan sabra, dancing horrors in the streets. And they were ending the alte Torah dike shtetl. They were ending that. They were replacing Yiddish with Hebrew. History was moving to a new place. I think that's what they all would have said. I don't know if Rabbi Shemaiah would have said that, or Rav Maimon, but most of the signers would have said that. And the same thing here, I think you're right, that these are all attempts at an abrupt rupture with what was, and we might say, although I'm not sure about France, but in American Israel, with a bissel a schmeck, ben wussi gevein. But they are abrupt, and therefore their beginnings are the significant moment. Whereas, again, let's take Hanukkah, for example, where we're not celebrating the inception of the war, we're celebrating the triumph, because there's not an abrupt rupture. It's a continuity, but all speculative on my part. But
I do think, however, that it's become safer in American society to celebrate July 4th because it's some sort of ideal as opposed to the reality of Cornwallis or maybe the acceptance of the American Constitution as a day of celebration. This document, which can be, you know, worn and interpreted and say all men are created equal. That's the part, because of that statement, that people can go back to it, even people that are aware that by the time the Constitution was developed and other things, you did not have that all men are created equal. You know,
nor did Jefferson mean it for a second. Please, let's not distort in terms of what Jefferson was up to.
It's interesting that it's almost safer to sort of celebrate July 4th, that day, than it is the day that the Constitution was ratified, or the day that was really essential in terms of the war, because it could allow us to sort of, like, you know, like the Mun, imagine it to be what we want. And it can imagine that America that, you know, could have those park celebrations where you have such different concepts of what America is, and yet frolicking together over this vague idea, which, you know, perhaps was never really realized completely.
Right. Although in Eretz Yisrael, I think the comparison there would be to say that in the Haredi world, that vague founding day carries no import whatsoever, except perhaps even negative to some degree. But in the rest of the country, there you might be correct that the West Bank religious Zionist and the Tel Aviv rioter might find Yom HaTzmut to be congenial to them. So there, except for the Haredim, who are sort of have seceded from citizenship, except for them, it might be true in Eretz Yisrael also. Might be. It's vague enough to include the Hilltop youth and the Meretz leadership.
It's interesting, in Eretz Yisrael, I heard growing up often that in the first few years after the Hakamas HaMedina, that the Degel did fly in Ponovich.
Bishant, still there. Absolutely, and bring usually some demonstrators from Yerushalayim to protest against it. But yes, it does still fly.
Yes. So, and Rav Chaim and Rav Yecheskel Sarna in Hebron also felt, especially in those first years, that this was a day to unleash that flag.
Reb Meshulam Roth, who was a Chotka Bechusid, he wrote an extensive tshuva explaining why Hallel should be said on Yom HaTzmut. So in the first days of the Medina, the Haredi world had not yet seceded from society. You know, when I was young, childhood, adolescence, even into my early 20s, I felt a strong connection with the Revolutionary War and Yankee Doodle and the Founding Fathers and the names of the signatories of the Declaration, which live today on the streets of Williamsburg, you realize. Lee, Penn, Bedford, Harrison. Why, these are all people who signed the Declaration of Independence. So that's an interesting footnote to history. But I felt a strong connection to it. I felt a strong linkage to the flag in sort of a irrational, pre-rational, mystical way. But what has become of late, I find very hard to conjure up those feelings. But when I do hear Yankee Doodle, or I do hear tunes of that America, which existed, you know, pre-Warren Court, I still do feel a little bit of a tinge of attachment and affection. And perhaps we could all conjure that up a bit.
And if you are putting your flag out, and of course, I encourage you to, remember the front piece from the Manual of Patriotism, a book that was issued by the New York City schools from 1900, the Manual of Patriotism, with its red for love. That red is love, the energy, the verve, the emotion that is love. And we've talked, of course, about the Constitution and the interpretation, but it should be white. White meaning clear and understandable, not vague and not opaque, but white for law. And the blue, which I guess is like the Tchelis in a sense, taking us to someplace beyond, whether it's the ocean or the heavens itself, the blue is for the hope that our fathers saw of a larger liberty. And if that means something where, Rav Meir, the masses finally become enlightened of Mole Arts Dea, that's a pretty great symbol of a hope for a future that is actually a law that is white and understandable, and a hope for liberty or chayrus, and something that can be really, I think, a stepping stone to the era that we all, I know, hope can be ushered in. As Rav Chaim Volozhiner says, the Golus in America is the letzte stancia, right? Now, he also sighed, as you know, Rav Meir, and said, "Aber dus vil sein a schwere, schwere stancia." Hopefully we have ridden over that schwerkeit of that stancia. Happy Independence Day. Be well.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you liked what you heard. If you did, please take a moment to share this or any of the many episodes available on our platform with friends in order to help grow our community. Until next time, Shalom.